Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, January 15th, 2009. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. Well, this week, Chris Colby, editor of Brew Your Own magazine, joins us to tell us how to use Cornelius kegs as fermenters. And why? Corny kegs are great places to store your beer, but why not let them be born there, too? If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And you can follow me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing. That's all one word. Orders for our 2009 Brewers Logbooks are still coming in. The logbooks have a calendar in the front to track your brews and space to log the details of 50 brewing sessions in the back. And I challenge you to fill it up. You can check them out on our online store, basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks again to everybody who's clicking on our Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us bring you this show, and we appreciate your support. Got some interesting feedback from our interview with Bruce Swiecicki on propane and propane accessory safety last week. No complaints about the Hank Hill impression, which surprised me. This letter comes from Roger in Lafayette, Colorado. Roger says, Bruce has to wear his official propane police hat when he's answering your questions, and although his answers are correct to the letter of the law, the common sense and real-world answers may be different. Can anyone legally recommend using a burner in the garage? No. But that being said, I do it all the time with an open window and the garage door up about 4 inches, with my carbon monoxide detector showing zero the whole time. The same detector jumps to 20 if I back a car in, so I know it works. Just make sure that you have a carbon monoxide detector with a readout and adjust your air mixture for blue-tipped flames. Yellow flames equals CO, carbon monoxide equals death. Roger says, the most dangerous thing about the whole adventure is having the propane tank and its rubber hose in an enclosed space with your house attached to it. I recently had an overfilled propane cylinder vent out through its overpressure valve while running my barbecue. The ensuing fireball was neat looking, but being immediately adjacent to my house and my eyebrows, it was a little scary. It had been cold out since filling it, but the barbecue heated up the cold tank, which increased the pressure and caused the purge. If a hose had melted, things could have been much worse. Well, thanks, Roger. Glad you weren't hurt. That sounds scary. I've gotten a few letters from brewers who say they use carbon monoxide detectors and will continue to brew in the garage, of course, while providing cross-ventilation and with the door cracked. And that works for the bad gas, you know, the carbon monoxide and such, but if your tank blows out for some reason, like Roger's did, inside your garage, that's another story. And I hope that doesn't happen to anybody, regardless of where you brew, inside or outside. Douglas Warzynski from Salt Lake City writes in. He says he's working on getting new episodes of Homebrewing Perspectives out there. I'm looking forward to that. Douglas also has thoughts on the indoor propane brewing discussion. He says, while it might make sense that carbon monoxide is heavier than air and would naturally vent out of a partially open garage door that opens from the bottom first, it seems toxic levels of carbon monoxide can build up. Last winter, I personally brewed in a garage with the door only partially open, along with a window and a smaller door to the outside in hopes of lending some cross ventilation, but staying out of the raw winter weather. I survived, but I can't claim that it didn't cost me any brain cells. Douglas says, shortly after that brew day, there was a story in local news about an elderly couple who had died during a power outage after they ran their power generator in the garage with the garage door partially open. Also, later that same winter, I was using a snowblower well into the open air of the driveway, and a carbon monoxide detector that I didn't know existed went off in the open garage several feet away. My takeaway from the whole series of events is that it is very possible to build up lethal levels of carbon monoxide in an open garage, but it is also possible to run a propane burner in a partially ventilated garage without triggering a carbon monoxide alarm. This says nothing of the good old-fashioned fire hazards. So no matter what you do or do not do in your garage, a carbon monoxide detector in the garage is a good idea. Thank you, Douglas. I think that is a good idea. I think if you are going to do the brewing in the garage thing, get a CO detector. On another topic, they're working on reforming the laws regarding home brewing up in Washington State. And as it stands now, you can brew at home legally, but essentially you can't take it anywhere except for competitions and exhibitions. And the only ones who can drink it at those events are judges. So forget taking homebrew legally to your neighbors or to the homebrew club meeting. Mark from Up That Way writes with an update. Mark says, last week our sponsoring senator, Senator Ken Jacobson, pre-filed our bill, which is now Senate Bill 5060. The proposed changes to the regulations would allow for homemade beer and wine to be removed from the house of production to be used for private consumption or use in community events such as tastings, club meetings, conferences, and competitions. We need all Washington homebrewers, winemakers, and their friends to contact their legislators and ask for their support of Senate Bill 5060. They can find out more about the effort and how to contact their legislator at www.wahomebrewers.org/legal. That's wahomebrewers.org/legal. It's just a matter of sending a simple email or making a call. All the information they need is on the site. And Mark says people can keep checking on the site for updates and get registered to keep in touch. We'll hopefully go to committee in the next few months. We'd like to get a bunch of folks together to attend the session. Anyone interested in helping can send a message to Mark Emily at mark@wahomebrewers.org. So Mark says, thanks for your help. With your listeners' help, we can help make Washington a more brewing-friendly state. I'm all for that. Good luck, guys. Speaking of legalities, Greg from Hawaii writes, I used to live in Maine, and we would jack our homebrew during the winter. We'd put extra homebrew in 1 gallon plastic water jugs and set it outside overnight in January or February. It would freeze completely, and then we'd bring it inside and turn it upside down over a big Oktoberfest mug until most of the color had melted out of the jug. The flavor doesn't change like it does during distilling, and the alcohol by volume goes way up. Of course, you lose any carbonation, but the beer is more like a liquor at this stage anyway. It's easy to end up with an overly hoppy product at this stage, though, so don't overhop the initial batch. Well, thanks, Greg. That sounds like fun. It also sounds like you're making an ice beer, which I believe under the current law is classified as distilling and is illegal. Silly, but silly to be illegal. But there you go. So whatever you do, don't freeze a jug of homebrew. Bring it inside and turn it upside down over a mug until the color drains out of the ice, giving you a tasty, hoppy, liquor-like substance. Don't do that. Sure, that'd be tasty next to a warm fire. You know, get a nice little jug of barley wine, freeze it. But don't do that. One more thing, Steve from Lansing, Michigan alerted me that his friend Rich has hooked up his beer fridge to post periodic messages on Twitter. That's right. There's a refrigerator with beer in it that tweets. And you can follow it at the username BeerFridge on Twitter. I have to warn you, though, that unless your name is Rich and this is your refrigerator, it doesn't stay interesting for very long. But, you know, it's it is a cool concept. Well, speaking of Twitter, thanks to everybody who sent in questions for Chris Colby on today's topic of fermenting in a keg. And that's what you'll hear right about now. Chris Colby, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hey, James. Thanks for having me.
We're going to talk about fermenting in a corny keg. It's a question that I've got every now and then, and there's a nice article by Forrest Whitesides in the January-February 2009 issue of Brew Your Own. And it looks like a pretty straightforward thing, but there are some things that you've got to watch out for, and we'll hopefully cover those. But first of all, if people are new to home brewing, they don't even know what a corny keg is, let's start at the very beginning. What is a corny keg, and where do you get one?
Well, the name is short for Cornelius Keg, and it's just a 5-gallon stainless steel keg that was originally used in the soda pop industry. Coke and Pepsi, you know, when you used to go order a fountain drink, there would be 5 gallons of syrup in a corny keg, and, you know, it would be hooked up to the dispensing mechanism, and that would shoot it out. Those were largely replaced by the bag-in-the-box thing that they have now, and so there's a lot of these corny kegs on the loose, you know, and available, and homebrewers found out a long, long time ago that they're great as homebrew kegs.
So are they still making them, or is there a danger of us ever running out of corny kegs?
The thing that they were basically made for is now gone. Almost all kegs you see these – or, well, almost all kegs I see these days are used. So I'm not sure. I mean, I do see them listed new sometimes in homebrew catalogs, and I'm not sure if that's new in that they've never been used or sold before, or new in that they're, you know, actually still being produced. That's just something I don't know.
So once you get a corny keg – What's the first step? How do you prepare it for being used in general and as a fermenter?
Well, when you get a corny keg that you want to use either for fermenting or for just kegging, you want to make sure that the keg isn't going to impart any flavors of, you know, what it's held before. The stainless steel can be cleaned, but there are rubber gaskets on the lid and there are rubber gaskets on the posts where the beer comes in and out. And what you want to do is completely disassemble the keg. Remove all the rubber parts and replace them. Any homebrew shop, or almost any homebrew shop, should have all the available rubber rings in a kit for you that's fairly inexpensive. So, you know, take the keg completely apart, replace the rubber parts, and just clean the keg thoroughly. One thing you can do is, if you think there's a lot of smell in there, is with water and add some baking soda for a while. That'll absorb a lot of the any smells or flavors that are sticking to it. But really, a good cleaning. It's stainless steel. You should be able to clean it, you know, just with your cleaning procedures.
Mm-hmm. I've got a couple of questions or a few questions from Twitter. Brett in Lakeville, Minnesota, and Chris in Amarillo, Texas, both had similar questions. The best way to ensure that your keg is sanitized. And Brett is actually having problems with infection with his keg, and he says, do you have to disassemble and sanitize it every time that you refill it? And he's using Star Sand, but doesn't seem to be working. So do you have to take the thing apart every time that you refill it or use it for a different purpose?
Well, certainly if you've been having problems with contamination, then, yeah, that's a good indication that maybe you should be. I mean, a lot of home brewers, myself included, will maybe let the keg go through. You know, if you fill it with one, if you're using it as a dispenser, if you fill it with one beer, you know, and you dispense it and, it, you know, there's no issues with contamination, I might let it, you know, I might push my luck and go. But you really want to, disassemble the frequent base and clean everything. And, you know, once it's clean, you know, just a couple minutes contact with Star Sand or with Iodofor should do it. One thing you can also try, and I do this every once in a while just to change my sanitation routine, is, you know, clean it and assemble it and fill like 180 degrees Fahrenheit to the top and just let it sit there. And, you know, basically if you know, 15 minutes over 160 degrees Fahrenheit should kill off anything that, you know, that's there. And, you know, since it's stainless steel, there's no problem with using, you know, heat as a sanitizer in that case. You can push that water out, you know, just like you'd push beer out with your CO2, and you can use that hot water later for, you know, cleaning more stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of times I'll serially clean kegs that way. I'll push hot cleaner through them, and then, you know, either sanitizer or, you know, sometimes if there's a bunch of clean ones, I can pump if I'm doing it by hot water, just pump hot water through them.
Another thing that he might want to try, he says, Brett says that he uses Star Sand. If that's not working for him, he might want to switch to Iodophore or another sanitizer to kind of change his sanitizing regime up a little bit to see if that makes a difference.
I just rotate through sanitizers. They really, any of them should work in perpetuity if you're getting your equipment, you know, sparkling clean like you should. But rotating sanitizers never hurts. Also, one thing I'd look to, if you've got a keg and you're having repeated problems with contamination, one thing to look at is what are you dispensing through. If you're getting, you know, a Cobra tap or hooking it up to a, you know, a kegerator and your dispense lines are dirty, you know, once you push beer through that, then the whatever's growing in your lines will just crawl down into your keg. So you make sure that, you know, everything coming in and everything going out. You might even want to, if you're really having problems, you know, replace the line going to your keg from the CO2, you know, or maybe stuff a little piece of cotton in before the, you know, to filter the CO2 coming out, because you never know. Maybe there's some dust or something inside your CO2 cylinder that's, you know, getting in there. It's probably unlikely, but if you're really having, you know, recurring contamination problems, it's best to think of, you know, every input to the keg, every, you know, and every exit, because the exit is also a source for things moving back up.
Right. Talking about fermenting in a corny keg, Mike Lozano, our buddy in Aurora, Colorado, asks, why would you want to ferment in a corny keg? And what are the kind of positives and negatives?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, the basic thing, one of the good things about homebrewing is that there are a ton of different ways to set up your home brewery. And, you know, it depends on what equipment you have, what, you know, you have access to. You know, fermenting in a corny keg is a good option in a couple situations. One is if you have a fermentation refrigerator. Depending on how big that is, you might only be able to hold one or two fermenting carboys in there because they're relatively squat, whereas you could maybe hold four or more, you know, fermenting cornies in there if you're doing that. Fermenting in corny also presents you with what I think is a real nice option is once fermentation's over, you just hook your CO2 to one end and you know, an outpost to the other end and a tube, and you can rack to a clean keg under CO2 pressure. So you do all your racking without exposure to air. And so those are, you know, I would say space and equipment issues, you know, if that's just what you want to do.
Also, in these days of the carboy shortage, where carboys are getting more expensive, it could be that maybe you can't get your hands on a carboy right now, or maybe all of your carboys that you do own are full of stuff and you want to brew. This is another option that you have. You know, if you've got empty corny keg and you don't have an empty carboy, well, this is an opportunity for you to be able to brew on that brew day.
Sure, and likewise, if you're putting a corny keg in the fridge and you happen to bump another corny keg, it's just going to go, you know, ping, whereas two carboys can make another sound followed by the brewer making much louder sounds that can't be presented on a family program like Basic Brewing Radio.
Good point. Mark Smith asks, do you use an airlock, or can you use the pressure release valve to vent periodically, or how do you handle the pressure of fermentation, and can you get too much pressure, and you know, does that affect yeast health, and basically, what do you deal with that? I mean, once you get the fermenting beer in this corny keg, it's going to be creating CO2 pressure. What do you do with that?
You don't, you know, ferment the beer in a sealed keg and use the pressure release valve. What you do is you hook a line to your beer out, or no, I'm sorry, the hook a line to the gas in connection, you know, have a length of tube going down into, you know, either a bucket or a 1 gallon, bottle filled with water or something, or you can have it just go into a fermentation lock. So you have, you know, you have the normal pressure release that you would on any fermentation vessel.
So the gas in will let gas out if there's not CO2 connected to the other end?
Right, because the gas post, you know, is short. It only it opens up at the very top of the keg. So any pressure, you know, as long as that's pushed in, goes out. And there's when you do that, you should have a special gas out or gas in post for that. You know, which special just means unscrew it and take out the little poppet in there, because that's just going to be in the way of anything. You know, you're already using that as a blow off tube that's got a small diameter, so don't restrict that further by putting or leaving the poppet in place.
So just to kind of disable the function of that valve by taking the guts out of it.
Right. Yeah, you need to do that, and there's two other things you need to do to use the corny keg. The one thing is, it's 5 gallons, the keg full to the top. And, obviously if you're fermenting 5 full gallons, the Kroisen is going to kick up, and it's going to have to go out the out that blow-off tube, and that's not going to be a good idea. So you should cut down the amount you're fermenting. Scale your recipe down to, 4.5 gallons or maybe even 4 if you're doing it in a corny keg. You lose a little bit of volume. If you choose the method, you're gaining enough functional advantages that you've chosen that method and you're willing to, deal with that. And the second thing you can use, there are foaming agents or anti-foaming agents that you can add. A lot of shops sell these now, like I forget what the name. I think Furman Cap S is the name of one of the ones that's used quite a bit. And you just add this, and that cuts down on the amount of, Kroisen kicked up in the fermenter. And between that, limiting the volume and the foam reducer, that should do, a good job, especially if you keep your fermentation temperature in line.
Firm Cap S, I think, is the official name of the product. If you're going to be doing web searches at your favorite online store or your favorite local store. And apparently, according to Forrest, that uses a similar ingredient to what's in Gas X. So I wonder if you could crumble up a Gas X and put it in the fermenter. I wonder if that would have the same or similar effect.
I don't know. there's one way to find out.
So we answered. We basically answered the question from Paul from Pittsburgh. Should an anti-foaming agent be used? And then MM Beerman asked, "What kind of volume can you expect?" So after it's all said and done, you could probably get 4 or 4.5 gallons of a beer out of it instead of 5.
Yeah, depending on what you start with in the fermenter, you're going to lose the usual amount to sediment or whatever. I would say, you lose maybe a couple quarts to the, all the stuff that sediments out on the bottom. Trube.
Now, this firm cap stuff, I've never used it, but I'm curious about it. Does it affect the head retention or the ability of, does it affect the head of the beer after you get it, after you're serving it, basically?
Yeah, it's not supposed to. I mean, no brewer would ever buy it ever if it, also killed your head. And that's kind of funny, because a while ago we ran a story on doing, you can dry out your beer by adding Beano.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you, if you made a beer, a dry beer in a keg using Beano and Gas X, you could probably certainly come up with some interesting names for it.
Wonder what other digestive products we can use in our brew.
Yeah. What else can we grab from the pharmacy and put in our beer?
Well, I've heard people putting condoms on their beer bottles to make sure that the seal was working on their capper. So, maybe we should stop there. Dan from Buffalo, New York asks, fermenting in a keg, can I have real ale? Or will I fight oxidation when drinking it? So is this the same as doing a cask ale?
Okay, no, that's different. Setting up you can set up a corny to do a sort of a real ale sort of simulator. But the story that we ran in this issue, it isn't really about that. If you search the BYO webpage, I think, I'm not sure if that article is online, but But we did do an article once about using a corny as a real ale dispenser.
Yeah, the thing with using the corny kegs is that you're pushing the beer with CO2, so it's not exactly the same thing. I mean, using a cask, you wind up getting air. Yeah, using a hand pump, you wind up getting air into the cask, unless you use a rebreather or something where you replace the space in the cask with CO2 to preserve the quality of the beer. But technically, I think that if you're doing a cask ale, you do have to worry about staling and oxidation because you are bringing air into the cask.
Right. When you do the corny as a cask thing, you lay it on its side, and if I remember right, you even slightly tip the what would be the bottom end up, and then air comes in through the gas in post, like actual air, and then you sort of just drain it, or you could hand pump it if you had a hand pump from the beer out, and yeah, that's more involved than what we're doing here, mm-hmm. and certainly any real ale application, you're going to have to worry about oxidation if you don't drink the beer fast enough. And, in British pubs, when they set that up, Jason, wasn't a big problem because, they'd tap the cask and like a day or so later, it would be gone, but if you're, if you're not, if you've got a real ale cask or a corny that you're tasking for that, and you don't drink the beer very fast, then, yeah, you would have to worry about oxidation.
Tim from Audubon, Pennsylvania, and Rob from Phoenix ask, is there a noticeable flavor or aroma difference between fermenting in a keg and fermenting in a carboy because of the geometrics? So, you're basically putting – I guess they're saying that because of the shape of the vessel – you may be affecting the fermentation characteristics. Is that an issue with something like a 5-gallon batch?
Commercial brewers have put a lot of energy into examining what different fermenter geometries, what effect that has on the final beer. And a lot of homebrewers, or not a lot, but some advanced homebrewers have read that and then sort of tried to port over the results from big commercial fermenters to little, homebrew fermenters. And the fact is, you can't really compare the two because of the difference in absolute size. Although a corny is a long, thin, tall fermenter, it's not going to have the same dynamics as, the 8-story fermenter they have at Miller Brewing, because there's, for one thing, the pressure in the bottom of your keg isn't any different. And, I would say, I've never really done an experiment or seen anyone do an experiment, but I would really doubt at a homebrew scale that fermenter geometry had that big of a deal to do with it. I mean, certainly, I think, unless you're a homebrewer who, every beer you enter in a homebrew competitions wins best of show, and, you've just absolutely reached the peak of, homebrewing godliness, even then, I don't know if I'd start to worry about fermenter geometry. It just seems like there's so many other, more worthwhile things that you could focus on to improve your beer or to do. I just, and I could be wrong, but I just don't think fermenter geometry is, at our scale, anything that really deserves more than a passing thought.
Tim from Seattle asks, what about dry hopping and or using things like wood chips, orange peel, that kind of thing, in the corny keg?
I wouldn't use those unless you really needed to in the primary, because, like I said, using this method, the blow-off tube is fairly constricted. And, the chance of clogging that would go up when you have things like that. If you wanted to ferment in the corny, then you rack it over to another corny in secondary and use oak chips, dry hops, spices, whatever, then, sure, that's you would do it just exactly like you would do that in any, serving vessel.
But if you rack from primary to the secondary and use a corning for both And you said that that's easy to do using CO2 to rack your beer.
Right.
You get the advantage of having it all enclosed in an envelope of CO2. But when you do things like put wood chips in the secondary, you got to think about when you're – if you want to serve from that secondary after a period of time of aging – you got to make sure that your serving tube doesn't get clogged up, right?
Sure, and that's why whenever you dry hop in the keg, or if you're adding spices or wood chips or whatever, most people put them in a bag, and that's still not 100% proof positive against blocking your up tube, but it usually helps.
And can you? Forrest also talks about racking with gravity. You don't have to use CO2 to rack your beer from one vessel, from the corny keg to another vessel.
Yeah, sure. You can rack normally. Just your racking cane essentially becomes the down tube in the keg plus, the get or beer out and the tubing that extends from it.
So is there anything different about using the keg as a secondary? I mean, you don't have to worry about a blow-off with a keg as a secondary. Do you even have to worry about venting the air at all?
Well, not really. It's secondary fermentation really isn't a fermentation, in the sense that there's active, the yeast isn't chewing through any more sugar, producing any more CO2 or whatever. One nice thing you can do, and he doesn't address it in the article, but it works, is you can, if you take gravity readings, very often, when you're within a few specific gravity points of your final gravity, you can rack the beer or push the beer from your primary fermenter to your secondary fermenter when it still has, a low level of fermentation going on right at the end. And then you just, you cap it. You don't provide any escape for the CO2 in the vessel you just racked it to, and that'll naturally carbonate the beer.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little tricky to do it that way because you have to sort of have exactly the right amount of sugar left in the beer. And then you'll also, there'll be, and this is really dependent on yeast strain, how much of the yeast is still in suspension at the time. With a flocculent yeast, most of the yeast might have dropped out by the time that the last, couple points are being chewed away. But with a, if you were doing 1056 and you tried that, it would be, almost all the yeast would still be in suspension because they don't really drop out until everything's attenuated and then, a couple of days later. That's a nice thing about using it as a secondary. You can, just rack it over when it's incompletely fermented and to a closed corny and let it carbonate that way. Although you do have the problem that you've got to calculate how much sugar you've got left from your specific gravity. And that requires a knowledge of what your final gravity should be. You would have had to have brewed the beer before and actually measured your final gravity. But it is an option.
So what do you do about the yeast slurry in the bottom if you do that? I mean, once the yeast does settle out, your dip tube's going to be down there amongst it. How do you deal with that?
Right. Let it settle out completely and sit for a couple of days, and then you're just going to have to pour 3 or 4 pints at the beginning that are yeasty and discard those.
I've also heard it suggested that you can shorten your serving dip tube, by cutting off a length of it. But it seems like to me that, well, you're going to be wasting a little bit of beer either way, I guess.
The way I look at it is it's kind of 6 of 1, half dozen of the other. Mm-hmm. either you end up pumping out or pushing out, a couple, more like a few pints of cloudy beer, or you leave, a few pints on the bottom.
What about harvesting yeast from the carboy? Joe from Folsom, California asked that. Seems like it'd be difficult to get down in there and get the yeast out or to pour it out, either one.
Yeah, if you're trying to top crop it, get yeast off the top, it's, the enclosure is kind of small, but then the yeast is right up there. And if if you've got a bottom strain and you're trying to get the yeast off of there, that can also be a pain. That's difficult. That's if that's a big concern of yours, I don't think I would use the corny keg method. It you can do it, but it's just more work because, like you say, it's a big, long, thin vessel.
Mm-hmm. Those are all the questions from Twitter. We didn't really cover in detail the process of racking with gas. I mean, for instance, if you're racking from a primary corny keg to another corny keg or a secondary carboy, there is a bit of finesse that you've got to use with the gas pressure.
Yeah, it's really simple, though. I've done it a million times, actually mostly with cleaning solutions, just because it's a simple way to do it, but with beer also. I mean, you just, let's say you've got a corny that you fermented in and a corny that's, going to be your serving vessel. Just hook up your gas to the fermenter and then make a what I call a jumper cable. You know, just take two beer out posts and connect them with a serving line. Connect that to both the posts on the beer out on both the kegs. Then all you really need to do is take the oval track off the receiving keg, because you need, as beer gets pushed into that, you don't want pressure building up. Then just turn on your gas. Lightly at first. You don't need to blast the beer out of the fermenter. And, it'll go up the up tube in the fermenter, out the tubing and down the tube in the receiving keg. If you want to, and you really would, get rid of the yeast at the beginning, let it start up, let it push over the first little yeasty bit, then just turn the CO2 off, or actually pull the post, and, dump that out, and then maybe even rinse the keg and try it again. But the CO2 is moving is really easy. You just hook the beer out to the beer out on the two kegs, essentially apply a little pressure, and it goes right over.
Is there anything else that we didn't cover? Is there anything that that you can think of that's outstanding that we haven't talked about?
I mean, it's really pretty straightforward. It's just another option that, like I said, depending on how you're set up, depending on what you're trying to do, you might want to think about. And certainly if you're wanting to vessel and then move that vessel under CO2 pressure so there's no risk of oxidation, it's a good method. It's also, if you want to try naturally carbonating your beer, by moving it over to a second corny when it's almost done fermenting, it's also a good option.
Very good. Well, thanks to everybody from Twitter for your questions, and thanks again to you, Chris.
Okay. Oops, my cat's standing on the damn keyboard. Like 3 or 4 times during the interview, she's been up here just like, and I've had to sort of, I don't know if you heard that, but I was dispensing her from the
from the menagerie that is the Colby household.
I think they just have no idea why I'm sitting and talking to this little microphone thing on the, they're like, what's going on?
I can has corny keg.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, Chris.
Okie dokie.
Well, thanks again to Chris Colby and his cats. You can pick up a free issue of Brew Your Own magazine by clicking on the BYO banner ad on basicbrewing.com. And if you decide to subscribe after reading that issue, you'll be helping to support this podcast. Remember, we've got the Brewer's Logbook and our new Basic Winemaking Introduction to Wine Kits DVD out on our online store. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com. Or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can check out our low-tech lagering and decoction mashing DVD on basicbrewingshop.com. There are also original DVDs, Introduction to Extract Home Brewing, and Stepping into All Grain. We've got combo deals on the site to save you a few bucks. And you can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order it online from us in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. We've got shirts of different colors. And thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Born Free Variable Flow Nipples, Twin Pack, and Mist 10th Anniversary DVD Edition. Both of those sound like fun things. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We appreciate your support there. And, I think we've got an Audible link out there, too. If you want to subscribe to Audible, get audiobooks online. Try that. That's all. Until next week. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson down in Austin. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.